Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and this is another episode where I'll be breaking down the news and information in the world of publishing and on the web with everybody that's listening. And for a short reprieve here and there, our producer Manny here will pop in.
Hey everybody.
Welcome back, Manny, and welcome back everyone. And Manny does a great job of curating a lot of the stories for the show behind the scenes, and so oftentimes he's got unique insights on some of this stuff that maybe I don't. And so it's been nice to kind of have the man behind the mirror, or the man, what do they say in The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain. Yeah, behind the curtain. Yeah. I wanted to say masked for some reason, but no, that didn't make any sense at all.
I think that's wrestling.
maybe. I'm sure we've got some wrestling fans that listen to the show. So I guess one of the things we've been doing is we've been kind of breaking down the stories unofficially into kind of different categories that seem to just be the sort of like bulk of what the news and information that really affects the world of publishing is sort of like you can kind of put them into these different buckets. And yeah, so we kind of look at it like AI, Google, and then sort of like the larger sort of industry, social, everything else that affects publishers. And we won't be hard and rigid on that necessarily, but I think it helps us make sure that the best and brightest information, if that you can say it that way, makes its way to you and makes its way onto the show. So first up, what else would it be other than AI? So this week in the world of AI, in terms of what's affecting our web publishers, is Microsoft Bing is struggling to gain market share despite AI enhancements. And we've got another story on why AI art in particular cannot be copyrighted. And that's something that we've talked about on the show before. Actually, both of these topics, really. And I would say that, you know, like we said at the start of this year on the show, this is going to be a space that evolves a lot and very quickly. I would liken it to something like email, you know, back in the early 2000s or late 90s, where it was kind of the revelation. But if you look at it now, especially in the context of, you know, something like a modern Gmail, it looks so different. And there's so many sort of protocols and just sort of like wide sweeping user behavior and sort of prominent software related enhancements and things like that that have come along the way that you can barely recognize it from the earliest forms of something like a Microsoft Outlook. And I don't think that AI is going to be much different. And you can kind of see this here with Microsoft is, you know, the sort of like storyline, or I guess narrative, that Google was going to disappear and Microsoft was going to quickly take their place because of AI, that you know, there was at least a little bit of momentum there. I think you could argue. I was a bit skeptical, although I was like, hey, Bing's having their moment. I do think that Bing is definitely in the mind sphere of the people that listen to this show. My wife, for example, however, it's like Bing is still the same Bing to her. And I do think that that's probably the majority of international and US-based like users. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, despite the AI powered enhancements that Bing's market share, Bing provides, Bing's market share remains pretty much unchanged. Bing's US market share was 6.47% in July, a slight increase from February. Microsoft disputes third party data, claiming more users actually are going directly to Bing's chat page. And then Microsoft's VP of, actually, it's search engine VP. Know this man, suggests internal data shows that Bing is taking more market share from data. So Yusuf Mehdi is actually the gentleman's name, and he claims that they are actually taking some market share from Google. One of the things to realize about when they do make these claims, it would be easy to say, well, they say, you know, that they're taking market share, but all the public information that's out there doesn't seem to suggest much of a difference. They are a public company, and it is something to where they could have a shareholder lawsuit levied against them or something along those lines if they actually didn't have some kind of data to suggest that, whether that's, you know, biased. I'm sure that it is. But in some ways, I do sort of like buy the concept that they have stolen a very, what I would say is like not something that Google is losing sleep over, amount of market share from them. Producer Manny, have you found yourself using Bing more than Google, or had you made the switch? Have you tried it at all?
I haven't tried it at all. Since we've been doing the podcast all year, it's been something that I remember we talked about a few months ago. And I was like, oh, that's cool that Bing is actually, you know, getting a lot more praise.
Good for them, right?
Like ChatGPT or even Google's AI. And then I just stuck with ChatGPT and, you know, got excited about Google's AI. I think that just goes to show like how dominant in the space Google really is. That just on the sheer name alone, people are like, nah, I'm not going to jump over to the other thing.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder if ChatGPT's innovations and improvements that they've made are, well, number one, I bet that ChatGPT is eating into more market share than Bing is. And on top of that, I would bet that ChatGPT, the one that is disrupting Google and the one that Microsoft has a partnership with, I'd bet that they're probably like a greater sort of like headwind to Bing and to Microsoft than Google is an incumbent. They are seeing increased usage in chat, though. This is according to SEO Roundtable. Despite stagnant market share, Bing chat usage has surged in recent weeks. Microsoft acknowledges server issues due to increased Bing chat usage, and a major infrastructure upgrade is anticipated to accommodate the growing demand. So I will buy that people are using, the people that are using Bing more are likely using sort of like their AI-based chat. To me, it would signal, and this is just me, industry inside baseball, is if I was Bing, I would spend the majority of my time then saying we're not a search engine, and I'd be putting most of my time and energy into being somebody that is creating something innovative and new. This chat is obviously what's driving new users to your platform. Bing is a search engine. Like, let's be honest, like they have a small amount of market share in that space, which for anybody not named Microsoft would be a boon. Like, you'd just be so thrilled, even if it was this very tiny piece of that market. It's worth a lot. But for Microsoft, it's a drop in the bucket. And so I think that the real opportunity here is to provide something that ChatGPT doesn't. They are integrated in ChatGPT. You can use it with Bing, although they've paused that to some degree because they are trying to navigate the legal consequences of doing it. So I do think it'll be interesting to see here, but I would say as a publisher, if you were, you know, pivoting towards a strategy in which you were trying to basically figure out how do you make content that, you know, Bing is going to find or, you know, churn up in their chat, I would say I don't know that it's worth the time and the energy now. There might have been, you know, enough there to suggest maybe to start getting ahead of it a few months ago, but now I would look at it more so as if you want to spend your time on, you know, like how do I make my content like ready for something other than a search engine, I'd spend my time on ChatGPT and rich markup based forms of populating content on the web, which in most cases, I think a lot of publishers, unbeknownst to them, actually have available to them. If you use WordPress, you can go to, I think it's wp-rest or -json on your site. So your site's URL /wp-json or rest. I can't remember. And then it's /json. So I think it's wp- for those that are writing this down, wp-rest/json/v2/posts. ? And then hit enter, and I think you'll see a little bit more about what I'm talking about.
I'll make sure to include that in the description too.
Yeah, it's for those that didn't just have a pen and pencil out, which it's the worst thing ever whenever somebody gives you a print and they have like a long URL on there. It's like, whoever made this like was completely disconnected from everything, because yeah, like who's gonna like verbatim type in, you know, a very long URL, especially if it's got a lot of letters and numbers. Anyways, pet peeve.
I mean, how bad do you want to go to that webpage, right?
I know, really. And usually it's like a sales one-sheeter or something like that. And you're like, I'd rather die. And So that kind of like kind of bridges us really well into this discussion we've had before on the podcast about AI art and can it be copyrighted? And, you know, you'll remember at the start of this year, there was the lawsuit in which, you know, artists were alleging that a ChatGPT agent trained on their stock photos is essentially stealing their content or stealing their, you know, like the rights to their imagery and stuff like that. And this has become a bigger question because the same thing could be said, and we talked about this a few weeks ago with a TV show. If AI can write an entire season of Friends, you know, what do you need writers for? But at the same time, it could write a whole season of Friends because you have the source material. It knows all the other seasons of Friends. Sorry, I didn't watch the show. Sorry if that's offensive to some people, just not my thing, but my example. So I would guess that Friends had like almost a 10 seasons or a dozen seasons. I don't know. But that's a lot of material to basically kind of get an idea of the plot points and things like that. You know, I had it write a children's book for one of my nieces when they were just in town, and it did a great job. And I did it mainly just so that I could give the characters the name of my dogs and different people and family members that they knew. And it made it fun for them. And it did a great job. You could go pull any children's book off the shelf at a bookstore, and I'm confident that they'd be indistinguishable from the one that it wrote. And I would say that the same could be said for Friends. And the only reason it can write a children's book is because it has all the other ones to use as a source material. And so the same can be, you can apply this to music and other forms of content. And, you know, producer Manny, you know, when you think about like sort of the things that you do and produce, I mean, even this very show, you know, at what point do you go, hey, if somebody starts creating a deep fake of me and a deep fake of you, God forbid, and then they've listened to the show enough, they curate some news, they chuck it in there. It's not outside the realm of possibility. You could just create an AI version of our show each week. At what point do you feel like that would be stealing?
I mean, that's really the question here, right? I mean, the wording that the court used was artworks created solely by artificial intelligence without human input. So what do you define as human input? If we're not on the show, but I'm editing the show every week, is that okay? You know,
yeah.
If we have AI characters for us, or is it something where I still have to research the stories and then AI takes care of everything else? Is that enough? So where do we draw this line?
Yeah, and you know, if you think about it, it's like my likeness, a deep fake of me, promoting that it is me, assumingly. You know, that seems like, especially when it comes to identity, that's a line that gets crossed. If they call this show the Publisher Lab, that seems like something that, you know, like we could obviously copyright the show or register a trademark or something. So that's a line that can get crossed. But your point about like there's this area where AI can do something that we haven't been able to do before, which is it can rip off something to a near like identical quality. Whereas before it's like you have Mad TV and you have Saturday Night Live. Yeah, it's the same concept, but like they're different shows and you know the difference. And you can just say, well, it's essentially they're doing the same things, but you can't copyright, you know, sketch comedy television show. You can't copyright a podcast about industry, you know, web industry and publishing. But the second that you start, you know, kind of wondering like, where is the parody at, you know, where it's like, that is clearly a deep fake of me. That is, you know, they call it the publisher fad or something like that. Don't do that, please, listeners. But the thing that I think about with it is that the case that they're talking about right now is this idea of artwork that's generated without human input, like you said. And to me, there's no such thing. You know, like that's like a computer that has no software on it, that has no operating system. It's just hardware. It just sits there. That's, you can kind of think of AI as like this digital ether-based hardware where you have all these different, you know, even the models themselves, realistically, it's like the models are based on training data that comes from people. So there's no such thing as an AI without human input. If we could have that, it would be, be very strange and interesting. So you can think of machine learning and the machine learning, you know, systems that are basically the underlying powers of most of the AI that we are using today. That's just a machine that has the ability to take information, write an algorithm based on sort of like a goal or a general direction, and then it uses that information to rewrite its own algorithm over and over again, in the same way that a brain does. So that's like saying, you know, like a child is, you know, only able to learn without any input from the world, because humans are the inputs and we're sort of like the mechanisms in which the machines are able to interact with the physical world. But yeah, like we go down to more of an esoteric sort of like discussion, I think, after that. But yeah, we'll keep our eyes on it. But it definitely is not a it's not a topic that I want to have to try to navigate personally. So I feel for the people that are having to make those decisions. That said, I have this just feeling in the pit of my stomach that the wrong decisions will get made. But we'll see. Moving on to sort of like our, you know, the other category that seems to dominate a lot of the news and discussion on the shows, our good friends at Google. So Google was accused recently of collecting children's data for advertising. And YouTube, correlatingly, maybe, perhaps you could imagine, has partnered with the UMG for responsible AI development. And so what this means is Google is finding themselves now in a similar position that Facebook did a while back, and then also Epic Games, who I believe is the creator and the developer behind Fortnite, which is a popular online game. And this is a very hard problem. This is, you know, like we're hard on Google on this show, and I've said this before. I know a lot of folks over there, and there's very smart people working on really good products, and we probably give them more sort of like give them a hard time probably more than we should. But you know, they play a very prominent role in our space and have done so on their own accord, and so I think they deserve maybe a little bit more scrutiny than everyone else. But in this case, there's a lot of challenges in sort of overcoming sort of the allegations levied against them here. So Google is accused of serving targeted ads to children and collecting their data. This potentially violates the 2019 settlement with the FTC over COPPA violations, COPPA. Analytics claims that YouTube shows personalized ads on videos marked made for kids. So if you've ever uploaded a video to YouTube, there's a little setting there as you're uploading and providing information about, you know, the title, the description. It says, is this made for kids? And if you check yes, you know, supposedly, and the way that it was supposed to work, and you could assume even, YouTube is going to both show those videos and also the ads on those videos differently, or treat them differently than they would videos that are, you know, not made for kids, I suppose. Even though it's like, it's a toggle of made for kids or just it's something else, which is weird bucket. I always thought it was a weird phrasing. But Google denies any wrongdoing and emphasizes that their protection of children is a top priority. So this is a hard problem because it's very hard to authenticate age on the internet. It just is. And I guess the caveat that you could give here is that, you know, they're showing personalized ads on videos marked made for kids. And I'd have to be more, Manny, are you familiar at all with the settlement in the FTC COPPA case and what they had agreed to or what the settlement actually like was?
I think the settlement was that they made a promise. That's how it was worded in these articles. They made a promise that they would not collect data from kids.
Gotcha.
Yet it seems through a third party investigation that they are definitely collecting this data. And because of that, you know, people are now scrutinizing Google for that.
Yeah, this is a classic Cambridge Analytica style case, although the scandal is far less, I would imagine. But so how this would work then is that, so if it's a third party, what's happening is that Google, so the ads served on YouTube come from Google Ad Manager, or you can think of it as sort of like the AdSense inventory as well, but especially on videos that are maybe, you know, owned and operated by large media publishers, they'll get an ad server and they're able to sort of like carve out sort of their inventory, certain types of viewers and stuff like that, and sell that in what they call private marketplace, which just means that they're able to choose which advertisers. So if they work with like 10 big brands, they can tell them, hey, you can go buy the premium ad inventory or ad space on our videos over here, where you can bid a little bit higher. It still runs through Google, still served through Google. And it, you know, like it's a certain, you know, maybe 10% of their video space that they're selling through those. And then Google will allow them to sell the rest of it on the open exchange, which, you know, is all of Google's advertisers inside of AdSense. And then you also have the massive amount of third-party ad networks and exchanges that all been inside of Google. So what's happening is that Google, to work with all these different parties in the exchange, they do have a data funnel that comes out of YouTube. And that means that, you know, there's cookies and trackers and stuff like that in that. And these third parties that they're working with, they're really great at sneaking in stuff that they're not supposed to collect data. And realistically, I would almost bet that whatever third party has been collecting this data that's helping them serve ads, Google's probably unaware of it. Or if they are, they've turned a blind eye to it. I would guess, it is just me hypothesizing, I suppose. And then on top of that, I would say that the third party, there's a really good chance that they didn't even know that they were doing it. This kind of stuff happens a lot where third parties actually don't understand the data that they're collecting and what it's getting used for. They just know that like they're collecting the data, and then maybe whatever, you know, sort of fence that they put around, you know, children's data or whatever, it's like that fence isn't secure enough to, you know, account for, I don't know, the way that the data is presented in an ad exchange, for example, because things don't always connect perfectly. It's not always apples to apples. So their fence that they may use to protect, you know, the data collected from children, maybe that fence is a little bit different than the one that Google provides. And so those things don't just add up. So a little bit like further down the rabbit hole for those that are interested in the topic. I won't spend too much more time on it because I know I got pretty boring there for a second. But YouTube, and a sort of like related but maybe also unrelated matter in this case, is partnering with Universal Music for responsible AI development. So the Music AI incubator that they're sort of partnering on involves artists in generative AI experiments and research. YouTube addresses challenges posed by generative AI, such as copyright abuse, something we talked about earlier. And this partnership aims to give artists more control over how their music is used with AI technology. So last week we talked about watermarks and the impact that, you know, like it's not a great system today. It's not going to be a better one tomorrow. And really, as an individual publisher, it's very hard to copyright your content in a way that makes it unable to be sort of stolen. And even if it is, then it's like you think about the legal like path that you have for some kind of restitution. It's very difficult. Publishers have always been in a tough spot in this case. However, when you start messing with the money and you start thinking about, well, if I can't copyright any content, it's a struggle for me. You know, you have to think, where does my content go? Well, YouTube, Google, Facebook, all these platforms, Universal Music, even to a larger degree, if you think about like musical artists, all of these artists are forced to give their content to these platforms to create a reach. And ultimately, these guys see a risk here too. So what do you need? Some nice content you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. And that's exactly what's going on with YouTube and this Universal Music group sort of AI development project, is they're trying to find a way that, yeah, an individual website or publisher or content creator may not be able to successfully sort of like keep people from stealing their original content. But all of them on the YouTube platform or all of them under the Universal Music Group probably could. So these are the parties that are likely going to be able to do something about the, you know, originality or origination of content. The downside of this and where publishers need to be really wary is over-promising this area, because these groups usually don't care about individual publishers. They care more about the herd. And so no one is going to protect you here. So I'd be very cautious. And ultimately, you know, there's no collective bargaining in this space. So unfortunately, you know, you can be as cautious as you want. But yeah, it's, your voice is not as strong as it probably should be in this matter. And that's a shame. But I would pay close attention to what's going on here. And, you know, with what power you have, I would say basically vote in your best interest, which is you don't want somebody else governing this, no matter who it might be and how much it might short term, you know, like maybe mitigate a risk or a concern or a fear that you have. No, Manny, does anything in that strike you as sort of like concerning, or maybe I'm just being cynical again?
I mean, I understand where they're coming from. Like if Drake or Snoop Dogg released a brand new album, but all that entire album was AI generated and you just changed it a little bit, but it's very distinctly Snoop Dogg's voice, should Snoop Dogg still get a cut? And I think that this is an interesting partnership that YouTube is now taking on that coincides with that US court story from earlier where AI is not going to be copyrightable.
Yeah.
So that just kind of further raises the question of where is that line?
It's a good question.
Where is that line? Should we copyright artwork? Should we not copyright music, or vice versa? Which way do we go?
Yeah. And with everything like this, it's whenever. I generally believe that all these things sort of find their own solutions. And usually how it happens is that somebody's money is grossly affected, and then it's grossly affected enough to where it's like somebody with a lot of money or somebody who having their money affected affects a lot of other parties. Then largely those problems start to get solved, or solutions get found, or that money is navigated over to some other area where, you know, sort of everything kind of moves. So I would say individuals in this space usually are never the winners. It's usually those that are on the right side of history. So as a publisher, I can say that, you know, creating original content, you're always probably on the right side of history. I just avoid, you know, staking all your whatevers to one wagon, however that goes. And our final sort of category for the day, and I'll kind of buzz through some of these, because I know that social media is maybe not on the top of mind in the same way that it is something like Google or AI. But I do find it really interesting because there's correlations here all across our industry. And that is the first story is actually one that should sound very familiar to publishers because it's an annual one. And this is brands have halted spending on X, formerly Twitter. And so brands have paused their ad spending on X due to pro, in quotes, Nazi content. X faces challenges amidst paywalling X Pro, which is them cutting off their API access to third parties for free. And we've also got, you know, these instances now of Instagram testing multi-advertiser ads, which is something that's so, and, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how publishers need to catch up to sort of like the content creators with the new Google follow this publisher function and stuff like that. And, you know, publishers becoming more like influencers or YouTubers. This is a case where the social platforms are actually, you know, trying to deal with the problems that the digital sort of like web has dealt with for a long time. So this is an instance where finally, you know, web publishers can kind of look back and go, haha, you know, now we're ahead of you. And, you know, brands saying, you know, they don't want their ads showing next to extremist content or hateful content. Publishers have dealt with this for a very long time. It's about that time of year where Procter & Gamble and Unilever decide that Google has, you know, done this too much, and they, you know, they raise a big stink about it. And then all of a sudden, Google says that they're going to provide better controls, and they roll out a whole bunch of features that somehow make Google more money, but are actually harder to navigate for advertisers. And we move on. And so now X will largely have to do the same thing. So good luck to them. It's a problem that cannot be solved with the existing infrastructure for advertising that we have today, programmatically at least. Now we've got X also saying that they're going to try to focus on their profitability. And this is something that they've struggled with, and they've talked a little bit about their future plans in this. So their new CEO, Linda Yaccarino, I've read the name many times, but I apologize if I don't quite get it right. I'm from the Midwest, and so you're going to find that I get a lot of names wrong. And so X's future and their profitability is really challenged by things that are sort of more existential. So you have, they've been talking about getting rid of the block feature. And, I think Elon has kind of drove home his perspective on the issue, is that you don't have the right to basically keep somebody's voice from being heard. You can mute it and you can try to not listen to it, but to physically stop somebody from being able to communicate is something they see as, against their sort of like principles. But it leads to the larger discussion, which X recently said that you have the freedom of reach, the freedom of speech, not the freedom of reach. And this is something that Facebook had said a long time ago when they had tamped down, and they'd gotten a lot of sort of the same sort of kind of pushback, both legally and just from the public, on, if you stop somebody from being, if you all of a sudden have an audience that you build and this platform keeps you from being able to reach it the same way, is that an infringement on your right to free speech? And producer Manny and I were talking about this before the show, but it's really a what, like whose sort of like lot do you want to throw yours in with? Because it's a glass half empty, glass half full, where does X have to provide you a boost to your voice? Freedom of speech means you have the freedom to talk about something. It doesn't mean you have the freedom to like be heard saying it. And that is something that has been established in terms of our law and our judicial system in the United States. However, that doesn't necessarily, it's not the same thing as this idea of reach, because if I build an audience, so if I'm out talking in the public square and a bunch of people come up and they start listening to me, if the authorities come along and start like pushing a lot of those people out, have you disrupted my right to free speech? No, not necessarily. However, by removing people from being able to listen to me, you sort of have disrupted sort of my right to be able to like say something to certain people. So it's this gray area, because what you've done is, even if it's a scenario in which they're claiming, well, we're amplifying some voices, not, downgrading others or whatever, you could still argue that not treating everybody the same means that there's a chance that I have an audience that wants to hear what I have to say, that you're stopping from hearing me. So you have this right to free speech. You have that. You don't have a right necessarily to be heard. So you don't have to have, nobody has to help you be heard saying whatever it is, whether it's hateful or inspiring or whatever. But when somebody does want to hear and a third party disrupts that, is that an infringement on your free speech? We don't know. Everybody, I'm sure I've got an opinion on it. Producer Manny, do you have an opinion on it?
It's kind of been the common theme for this episode. There's so many just gray areas and fine lines that we're walking. Because, like, you can make an argument that if someone says something, too crazy, like, it could cause damage. But at the same time, we don't want to infringe on their rights. So, it's a toss-up.
Yeah, and I think you always have to look at this with the worst cases in mind, because it really gives you that idea of, like, what are the rights? So if it's something that actually causes physical harm, like the screaming fire in a, crowded theater or whatever, we have sort of like parameters for that, but we don't have parameters for whenever somebody is, stopping somebody else from listening to you whenever they want to listen. And I think that that's going to be something that is not going to be solved anytime soon. It's complicated enough from a, you know, just sort of like thinking through it from a, you know, mental exercise standpoint, that I don't imagine the legal sort of like chain of events from here on out is going to get much simpler. So yeah, I would say don't count on anything too soon on that. And then the last that we had in sort of in our social realm was Instagram's new ad layout. So Instagram's testing a new ad layout, combining 4 sponsored posts into 1 screen. So you can think of this as, you know, ads jammed into 4 quarters of an ad space, as opposed to 1 big one. And the new format, you know, one of the things that was talked about in the story was this new format might lead to user annoyance, affecting CTR and ROI from advertisers. Advertisers worry that the format isn't designed to help users discover and compare products from various businesses, which is why Instagram made it and one of the reasons why they think that it's a good format. So this is an area where I get kind of frustrated with sort of like the advertising journalism space, because nobody knows. I hate whenever people reference user experience or whatever, whenever what they mean is my opinion about what a user likes and what a user doesn't like is that this is bad. Let's say you have a 300 by 250 ad space. What's the difference to a user if there's 1 big ad or 1,000 little ones in there? Now that's an advertiser experience that might suck, because the advertiser might feel like they're not going to get the same level of engagement. Now imagine for an advertiser, you can say you can have 1 big ad for $1, or you can have 1/4 of a big ad for 25 cents. For $1, you know, you get the whole space. Maybe that's more engaging to a user. For 25 cents, 1/4 of the cost, maybe not quite as engaging, but like maybe still a chance. So like, you know, that's their call to make. And for Instagram, if it is something that's affecting users, that's for them to measure and to be able to decide, you know, is the cost benefit, you know, worth it? Because ultimately, and publishers, you guys are in this boat too, you get to decide what the price is for your content. Content isn't free. It doesn't come out of thin air. Somebody makes it. And so content has a price, and it's up to every person that sells their content what that price is. And so if Instagram is like, yeah, it's annoying to our users, but advertisers pay us more, Instagram is free to use if you want to see ads. If you don't want to see ads, they don't have an ad-free model. So it's your only choice. That's the price. If I don't want to buy something because it's too expensive, I don't buy it. I think that's pretty simple. But we did have some questions this week actually coming from users. I think we got kind of like a backlog here of a couple questions that have popped up over. So Manny, what do we got?
So we got a question from Craig Smith -UI2XX on YouTube. Can you cover the upcoming deprecation of third-party cookies in 2024 and how it will affect publishers? Also, what steps will Ezoic take to maintain publisher ad revenue?
So we got one question here on Ezoic specifically. So the depreciation of third-party cookies, I think 2019 was when it was supposed to happen. So 2024 now, weird because every year in between was like the year. I've covered this in a lot of different places and even on this show before, but I'll give you the brief example, which is, you know, a war is unfair and, you know, there's an asymmetry of data or asymmetry of capability. If one country has guns and weapons and airplanes and the other country doesn't, they have horseback and they've got their fists and sticks. It's unfair. And what you're going to see is that the party that has the weaponry is going to be the one that's dominant. And so with third-party cookies going away, I mean, they've been gone for everything that's not basically like Chrome and desktop for a long time. And so you're going to see already that weakens the majority of web traffic. So it doesn't apply to like 60% of all visits across the internet. Beyond that, really, it's only Google who's self-imposed this, you know, sort of deadline that they keep kicking back on themselves. And, you know, it's giving them an advantage. Once it goes away, everybody else will just be on an even playing field, because right now you have this hybrid model where in some cases you can use third-party cookies for targeting and in other cases you can't. Apple blocks it all on any Apple devices. And so they, you know, that disrupted Facebook a while back. So nothing will happen. Publishers should make more money because it'll affect advertisers more than publishers, because advertisers now can't just throw a cookie on a web page and then say, I want to just target those people. That system is not really as good as Google and Facebook sold it to them a decade ago when they were the ones that pushed this and promoted it. They said, just put these pixels on. They're like, you know, infallible, and you're going to be able to buy this audience that you know is the right one for really cheap, and it'll be great. The problem is that it doesn't work that way. Like, I mean, any advertiser now that's worth their salt, especially running programmatic campaigns, you know, you got to keep an eye on that stuff because those audiences are just not accurate, and they expand them. They say you want to find visitors like those visitors. Well, visitors that are like visitors that visit azorp.com, for example, it's, you know, like, I don't know what they would say lookalikes are, but if you start pairing them with like topics like WordPress and stuff, it's like we're likely to get, you know, development agencies, which are not our customers. So I would say that third-party cookies are really bad for advertisers and made them lazy. And now they need to care about where their ads show, and they need to put more time and energy into how they structure audiences and campaigns. And that means that if you make good original content, you should make more money from it. So that's how it'll affect publishers. And everybody wants to make you scared of this. If you're a publisher, by the way, everybody wants you to be afraid of it because they want you to sort of like say, well, I need to get bundled together with, you know, or go with this platform or, you know, this, you know, party, because they say they've got something that replaces third-party cookies. There's no replacement. And everybody wants to be the one that comes in and replaces something. But Google would never let that happen. And no one else is even remotely big enough to even put a dent in it. So just to give you guys an idea, there's a lot of parties in this space that want you to think differently about that. And I'm here to tell you with no horse in the race that there's absolutely there's no risk there. And then we got other questions about it. Looks like mostly Azoic questions here, Manny.
Yeah, we got one from Gene, and I'll include the full username because I don't want to mispronounce anything. Is there anyone that could help me get past the final barrier of ad manager approval?
That's an interesting one. So we don't talk very much about Azoic on the show. I hopefully our listeners appreciate the fact that one of the things that made this show good from the very start was I completely like kind of separated from my role as an executive at Azoic. But you know, there are cross layers where it's like either our experiences or different things like that cross over, and I'm happy to talk about it. But this question is actually a kind of an Azoic support question. The question for is how do you get ad manager approval? Well, through a partner like Azoic, you're actually getting what they call a child account. So Google Ad Manager is Google's ad server, and where a lot of the antitrust legislation has come from recently, short aside, is really from the fact that Google's ad manager, their ad server, is connected to the world's largest ad exchange, Google's ad exchange. So if you're a publisher and you make any money ever from ads programmatically on display, with maybe extreme rare exceptions, mostly from large publishers, you cannot make enough money from ads to, you know, be even remotely relevant to what you do without a party like Google. So AdSense is just Google's inventory. And the reason why publishers want access to Google Ad Manager is they don't really want Google's ad server, which is just a piece of tech that's arguably not even the best ad server that's out there. They want access to Google's ad exchange, which is only available through Google Ad Manager, which means you get all of Google's advertisers inside of AdSense, plus thousands of other ad networks that all bid in there. So you go, why would these ad networks bid against each other and bid against Google in this open market when, you know, like Google is their competitor? Why would they help them? It's because Google's reach, the number of sites that show Google ads, is just, it's too much business to pass up. You could never, I mean, you can't make it as an ad network not bidding inside of Google's ad exchange. And because of that, it makes a lot more money than something like AdSense. So everybody wants access to it. And most publishers have no idea what the difference between ad exchange, Google's ad exchange, an ad network, what a partner like Azoic or a Google certified partner that is providing access to ad manager. Nobody understands the differences between these things. But for ad manager approval as a child account, the main things you need to worry about are basically Google policy issues. And so you want to make sure that you're aligned with Google policy. And then outside of that, Inside Baseball on Azoic is like, you're probably using the wrong email account. Whatever account AdSense or Google accounts your site may be already connected to, if you're using a different email address or something like that, sometimes that can be an issue. So somebody can fix that for you. And then one more question here, and it's pertaining to Azoic in particular on our future. And Manny, I'll let you kind of like break this one down for me.
Yeah, so JBN011A on YouTube asked, is Azoic still solid and safe for publishers to use? What does Azoic have in store for the future?
Extremely safe. Depends on two definitions here, but I guess from a, I'm guessing they mean maybe from a financial standpoint, we've been a profitable company for the majority of the last decade, and one of the few ones that have been. We've been very responsible. We've been a growth company that has been very leery of sort of like the trappings of, you know, getting overextended. And so, like everyone in the tech space, we've unfortunately had to do layoffs and other things like that over the last, you know, 4 to 6 months. And, you know, that's tough. But I think AI blunts a lot of that because everybody's able to do more. That being said, Azoic is one of the largest partners. I mean, if you go look at our footprint, you know, when you look at global internet traffic, I think global internet traffic running through a proxy or a CDN, which is the majority of Azoic sites and our visitors that we see each month, make up almost 1% of the entire internet. And so if you associate Azoic with something like ads, anybody else that's not Google or Amazon or something like that, they don't even show up on the radar. So we're still the largest and biggest company in this space doing anything like what we're doing. And so I think we're pretty safe on that accord, safer than anybody else. And then as it relates to safe for, you know, the future, I would say safe from the standpoint of, you know, protecting your site against weird policy stuff and being able to navigate changes in the space. We spend probably considerable engineering time to help publishers stay prepared for things like CCPA, GDPR, ads.txt, third-party cookies. We have engineers that are working on that stuff all the time. And I think that, you know, that's a huge benefit to publishers, because that's the most frustrating thing about this space is how so much stuff comes along to stop a problem. It doesn't work. And then publishers end up getting saddled with the responsibility for it. Ads.txt is a great example of that. And in store for the future, I would just say, our mission, if we have one, is that we help publishers. So what is it that will help publishers into the future? It's being able to build audiences as much as it is to be able to build revenue from their content. I think building audiences in the future looks quite a bit different than it does today. But one thing is for sure, and that's content is king. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, if you've ever heard that before. And so, yeah, I think we're going to help publishers continue to make and market their content, but monetize their content as well. And, you know, where that lives and how it looks might look different in the future. And so we're trying to anticipate that as best we can. And I think that's it. Producer Manny, thanks for joining me again today. I appreciate you spinning the wheels and potting me up and potting me down. And thank you to all of our loyal listeners. If you have a question or a comment, you can go to publisherlab.org. Would love to hear from you and answer any questions that you have here live on the show. And you can catch us or watch us pretty much anywhere you catch or listen to podcasts. YouTube is the best place to find us if you want to watch the show. And I think that's it. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening to another episode of The Publisher Lab.